Chapter 17. The Right to Sanctuary. Refuge and Prospect are opposites. Refuge is small and dark. Prospect is expansive and bright. We need them both, and we need them together. Grant Hildebrand, Finding a Good Home, Origins of Architectural Pleasure. 1. Big Other Outruns Society. That summer night when our home was destroyed by a lightning strike, we watched in the driving rain as the gables and rambling porches exploded in fire. Within hours, a smoldering field of black ash covered the ground where home had been. In the months and years that followed, my recollections of the house took an unexpected shape. Less rooms and objects than shadow, light, and fragrance. I conjured in perfect clarity the rush of my mother's scent when I opened the drawer filled with her once cherished scarves. I closed my eyes and saw the late afternoon sun slicing through the velvety air by the bedroom fireplace, with its ancient sloping mantle where our treasures were on display. A photo of my father and me, heads tilted toward each other, blending our two shocks of curly black hair. The miniature painted enamel boxes discovered in a Parisian flea market years before the thought of motherhood, which later became the shelter for our children's milk teeth, huddled like secret caches of seed pearls. It was impossible to explain the quality of this sadness and longing, how ourselves and the life of our family had evolved symbiotically with those spaces that we called home. How our attachments transformed a house into a hallowed place of love, meaning, and commemoration. My difficulty began to ease only when I discovered the work of Gaston Bachelard, an extraordinary man who had been a postal worker, physicist, philosopher, and ultimately a professor of philosophy at the Sorbonne. The old house, for those who know how to listen, is a sort of geometry of echoes. The voices of the past do not sound the same in the big room as in the little bedchamber. Among the most difficult memories, well beyond any geometry that can be drawn, we must recapture the quality of the light. Then come the sweet smells that linger in the empty rooms. One of Bachelard's work in particular, The Poetics of Space, is instructive as we reckon with the prospects of life in the no-exit shadow of Big Other and its power brokers behind the curtain. In this book, Bachelard elaborates his notion of topoanalysis, the study of how our deepest relationships to inner self and outer world are formed in our experience of space, specifically the space we call home. The house shelters daydreaming. The house protects the dreamer. The house allows one to dream in peace. The house is one of the greatest powers of integration for the thoughts, memories, and dreams of mankind. It is body and soul. It is the human being's first world. Before he is cast into the world, man is laid in the cradle of the house. Life begins well. It begins enclosed, protected, all warm in the bosom of the house. Home is our school of intimacy, where we first learn to be human. Its corners and nooks conceal the sweetness of solitude. Its rooms frame our experience of relationship. Its shelter, stability, and security work to concentrate our unique inner sense of self, an identity that imbues our daydreams and nightdreams forever. Its hiding places, closets, chests, drawers, locks, and keys satisfy our need for mystery and independence. Doors, locked, closed, half shut, wide open, trigger our sense of wonder, safety, possibility, and adventure. Bachelard plumbs not only the imagery of the human house, but also of nests and shells, the primal images of home that convey the absolute primitiveness of the need for a safe refuge. Well-being takes us back to the primitiveness of the refuge. Physically, the creature endowed with a sense of refuge huddles up to itself, takes cover, hides away, lies snug, concealed. A human being likes to withdraw into his corner. It gives him physical pleasure to do so. The shelter of home is our original way of living in space, Bachelard discovers, shaping not only the existential counterpoint of home and away, but also many of our most fundamental ways of making sense of experience. House and universe, refuge and world, inside and outside, concrete and abstract, being and non-being, this and that, here and elsewhere, narrow and vast, depth and immensity, private and public, intimate and distant, self and other. Our family instinctively pursued these themes in imagining a new home. When we were finally able to undertake that project, we foraged for durable natural materials. Old stone and scarred wooden beams that had weathered the storms of time. We were drawn to old furniture that had already lived many lives composing others' homes. This is how the walls of the new house came to be massive, nearly a foot deep and packed with insulation. The result is just as we had hoped, a lush and peaceful stillness. We know that nothing guarantees safety and certainty in this world, but we are comforted by the serenity of this home and its layered silences. The days unfurl now within the embrace of these generous walls, where once again our spirits spread and root. This is how a house becomes a home, and a home becomes a sanctuary. I feel this most acutely when I crawl into bed at night. I wait to hear my husband's breathing in syncopation with the muffled sighs of our beloved dog on the floor beside us as she sprints through her ecstatic dreams. I sense beyond to the dense envelope of our bedroom walls and listen to their lullaby of seclusion. According to Big Other's architects, these walls must come down. There can be no refuge. The primal yen for nests and shells is kicked aside like so much detritus from a fusty human time. With Big Other, the universe takes up residence in our walls, no longer the sentinels of sanctuary. Now they are simply the coordinates for smart thermostats, security cameras, speakers, and light switches that extract and render our experience in order to actuate our behavior. That our walls are dense and deep is of no importance now, because the boundaries that define the very experience of home are to be erased. There can be no corners in which to curl up and taste the pleasures of solitary inwardness. There can be no secret hiding places, because there can be no secrets. Big Other swallows refuge whole, along with the categories of understanding that originate in its elemental oppositions. House and universe, depth and immensity. Those ageless polarities in which we discover and elaborate our sense of self are casually eviscerated as immensity installs itself in my refrigerator. The world chatters in my toothbrush. Elsewhere stands watch over my bloodstream, and the garden breeze stirs the chimes draped from the willow tree only to be broadcast across the planet. The locks? They have vanished. The doors, they are open. In the march of institutional interests intent on implementing Big Other, the very first citadel to fall is the most ancient, the principle of sanctuary. The sanctuary privilege has stood as an antidote to power since the beginning of the human story. Even in ancient societies where tyranny prevailed, the right of sanctuary stood as a failsafe. There was an exit from totalizing power, and that exit was the entrance to a sanctuary in the form of a city, a community, or a temple. By the time of the Greeks, sanctuaries were sacred sites built across the ancient Greek world and consecrated to the purposes of asylum and religious sacrifice. The Greek word asylon means unplunderable, and founds the notion of a sanctuary as an inviolable space. The right of asylum survived into the 18th century in many parts of Europe, attached to holy sites, churches, and monasteries. The demise of the sanctuary privilege was not a repudiation, but rather a reflection of social evolution and the firm establishment of the rule of law. One historian summarized this transformation: justice as sanctuary. In the modern era, the sacredness, inviolability, and reverence that once attached to the law of asylum reemerged in constitutional protections and declarations of inalienable rights. English common law retained the idea of the castle as an inviolable fortress and translated that to the broader notion of home, a sanctuary free from arbitrary intrusion, unplunderable. The long thread of the sanctuary privilege reappeared in U.S. jurisprudence. Writing in 1995, legal scholar Linda McLean argued that the equation of home with sanctuary has depended less on the sanctity of property rights than on a commitment to the privacies of life. As she observed, there is a strong theme of a proper realm of inaccessibility or secrecy with respect to the world at large, as well as a recognition of the important social dimension of such protected inner space. The same themes appear from the perspective of psychology. Those who would eviscerate sanctuary are keen to take the offensive, putting us off guard with the guilt-inducing question, "What have you got to hide?" But as we have seen, the crucial developmental challenges of the self-other balance cannot be negotiated adequately without the sanctity of disconnected time and space for the ripening of inward awareness and the possibility of reflexivity, reflection on and by oneself. The real psychological truth is this: if you've got nothing to hide, you are nothing. One empirical study makes this point. In Psychological Functions of Privacy, Darrell Peterson defines privacy as a boundary control process that invokes the decision rights associated with restricting and seeking interaction. Peterson's research identifies six categories of privacy behaviors: solitude, isolation, anonymity, reserve, intimacy with friends, and intimacy with family. His study shows that these varied behaviors accomplish a rich array of complex psychological privacy functions, considered salient for psychological health and developmental success: contemplation, autonomy, rejuvenation, confiding, freedom, creativity, recovery, catharsis, and concealment. These are experiences without which we can neither flourish nor usefully contribute to our families, communities, and society. As the digital era intensifies and surveillance capitalism spreads, the centuries-old solution of justice as sanctuary no longer holds. Big Other outruns society and law in a self-authorized destruction of the right to sanctuary as it overwhelms considerations of justice with its tactical mastery of shock and awe. The facts of surveillance capitalism's dominance of the division of learning, the unrepentant momentum of its dispossession cycle, the institutionalization of its means of behavior modification, the convergence of these with the requirements of social participation, and the manufacture of prediction products for trade in behavioral futures markets are de facto evidence of a new condition that has not been tamed by law. The remainder of this chapter explores the implications of this failure. What will taming require? What kind of life is left to us if taming fails? 2. Justice at the New Frontier of Power. If sanctuary is to be preserved, synthetic declarations are required, alternative pathways that lead to a human future. It's the wall, not the tunnels, that requires our attention. So far, U.S. privacy laws have failed to keep pace with the march of instrumentarianism. Analyses of the invasion of privacy, according to legal scholar Anita Allen, fall into a handful of easily illustrated categories. Allen contrasts physical privacy, sometimes called spatial privacy, with informational privacy. She observes that physical privacy is violated when a person's efforts to seclude or conceal himself or herself are frustrated. Information privacy is disturbed when data, facts, or conversations that a person wishes to secret or anonymize are nonetheless acquired or disclosed. In the era of Big Other, though, these categories bend and break. Physical places, including our homes, are increasingly saturated with informational violations as our lives are rendered as behavior and expropriated as surplus. In some cases, we inflict this on ourselves, typically because we do not grasp the backstage operations and their full implications. Other violations are simply imposed upon us, as in the case of the talking doll, the listening TV, the hundreds of apps programmed for secret rendition, and so on. We have surveyed many of the objects and processes already earmarked to be smart, sensate, actuating, connected, and internet-enabled by surveillance capital. By the time you come across this information, there will be more, and more after that. It's the sorcerer's apprentice, cursed with a perpetual filling and refilling, driven by an unbounded claim that asserts its right to everything. When U.S. scholars and jurists assess the ways in which digital capabilities challenge existing law, the focus is on Fourth Amendment doctrine as it circumscribes the relationship between individuals and the state. It is, of course, vital that Fourth Amendment protections catch up to the 21st century by protecting us from search and seizure of our information in ways that reflect contemporary realities of data production. The problem is that even expanded protections from the state do not shield us from the assault on sanctuary wrought by instrumentarian power and animated by surveillance capitalism's economic imperatives. The Fourth Amendment, as currently construed, does not help us here. There is no sorcerer in sight ready to command the surveillance capitalists, in Goethe's words, corner boom, hear your doom. Legal scholarship is just beginning to reckon with these facts. As a 2016 article on the Internet of Things by Fourth Amendment scholar Andrew Guthrie Ferguson concludes, if billions of sensors filled with personal data fall outside of Fourth Amendment protections, a large-scale surveillance network will exist without constitutional limits. As we have seen, it already does. Dutch scholars make a similar case for the inadequacy of Dutch law as it falls behind Big Other. No longer able to effectively assert the sanctity of the home from the invasive action of either industry or the state. The walls no longer shield the individual effectively from the outside in the pursuing of personal life without intrusion. Many hopes today are pinned on the new body of EU regulation known as the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, which became enforceable in May 2018. The EU approach fundamentally differs from that of the US in that companies must justify their data activities within the GDPR's regulatory framework. The regulations introduce several key new substantive and procedural features, including a requirement to notify people when personal data is breached, a high threshold for the definition of consent that puts limits on a company's reliance on this tactic to approve personal data use, a prohibition on making personal information public by default, a requirement to use privacy by design when building systems, a right to erasure of data, and expanded protections against decision-making authored by automated systems that imposes consequential effects on a person's life. The new regulatory framework also imposes substantial fines for violations, which will rise to a possible 4% of a company's global revenue, and it allows for class action lawsuits in which users can combine to assert their rights to privacy and data protection. These are vital and necessary accomplishments, and the question that is most important to our story is whether this new regulatory regime can be a springboard to challenging the legitimacy of surveillance capitalism and ultimately vanquishing its instrumentarian power. In time, the world will learn if the GDPR can move out in front of Big Other, reasserting a division of learning aligned with the values and aspirations of a democratic society. Such a victory would depend upon society's rejection of markets based on the dispossession of human experience as a means to the prediction and control of human behavior for others' profit. Scholars and specialists debate the implications of the sweeping new regulations, some arguing the inevitability of decisive change, and others arguing the likelihood of continuity over dramatic reversals of practice. There are some things that we do know, however. Individuals, each wrestling with the myriad complexities of their own data protection, will be no match for surveillance capitalism's staggering asymmetries of knowledge and power. If the past two decades have taught us anything, it is that the individual alone cannot bear the burden of this fight at the new frontier of power. This theme is illustrated in the odyssey of Belgian mathematician and data protection activist Paul-Olivier Douay, who in December 2016 initiated a request for his personal data collected through Facebook's custom audiences and tracking pixel tools, which would reveal the web pages where Facebook had tracked him. Douay probably knew more about the rogue data operations of Cambridge Analytica than anyone in the world outside of its own staff and masterminds. His aim was a bottom-up investigative approach to uncover the secrets of its illegitimate means of political behavior modification. A first step was to determine what Facebook knew about him, especially the kind of data that would become relevant in an electoral context and thus make him and others vulnerable to the kinds of hidden maneuvers that Cambridge Analytica had employed. Douay wanted to understand how a citizen might come to ascertain the data that enabled, judging from the worldwide outrage over the revelations of secret online political manipulation, what many people consider a highly consequential threat. He carefully documented the twists and turns of his journey, hoping that his experience would be useful for journalists, citizens, and communities determined to understand the scope and political vulnerabilities of Facebook's practices. Douay writes, "It is, of course, extremely difficult to talk to a company like Facebook as an individual. So by April 2017, I had to escalate the matter to the Irish Data Protection Commissioner. By October 2017, after a lot of prodding, the Irish Data Protection Commissioner finally agreed to take the first step with my complaint and ask Facebook for a comment. By December 2017, they had apparently received a response. But as of March 2018, they are still assessing it, despite frequent reminders. It is very hard not to see a problem here with respect to enforcement." In March 2018, 15 months after his initial request, Douay finally received an email from Facebook's privacy operations team. He was told that the information he sought is not available through our self-service tools, but is stored in Hive, Facebook's log storage area, where it is retained for data analytics and maintained as separate from the databases that power the Facebook site. The company insisted that accessing the data required it to surmount huge technical challenges. "This data," the company writes, "is also not used to directly serve the live Facebook website which users experience." In our language, the information that Douay sought required access to the shadow text, specifically asking for, among other things, details on the targeting analyses that determined the ads he was shown on Facebook. The corporation's response indicates that Hive's data are part of this exclusive second text, in which behavioral surplus is queued up for manufacture into prediction products. This process is completely separate from the first text, which users experience. Facebook makes clear that the shadow text is not available to users, despite the promotion of its self-service download tools that promise to give users access to their personal data retained by the company. Indeed, the competitive dynamics of surveillance capitalism make the shadow text a crucial proprietary source of advantage. Any attempt to breach its content will be experienced as an existential threat. No surveillance capitalist will voluntarily provide data from the shadow text. Only law can compel this challenge to the pathological division of learning. In the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal in March 2018, Facebook announced it would expand the range of personal data that it allows users to download. But even these data remain wholly contained within the first text, composed largely of the information that users themselves have provided, including information that they have deleted: friends, photos, videos, ads that have been clicked, pokes, posts, location, and so on. These data do not include behavioral surplus, prediction products, and the fate of those predictions as they are used for behavioral modification, bought and sold. When you download your personal information, you access the stage, not the backstage, the curtain, not the wizard. Facebook's response to Douay illustrates another consequence of the extreme asymmetries of knowledge at play. The company insisted that access to the requested data required it to surmount huge technical challenges. As behavioral surplus flows converge in machine learning-based manufacturing operations, the sheer volume of data inputs and methods of analysis moves beyond human comprehension. Consider something as trivial as the case of Instagram's machines selecting what images to show you. Its computations are based on varied streams of behavioral surplus from a subject user, then more streams from the friends in that user's network, then more from the activities of people who follow the same accounts as the subject user, then the data and social links from the user's Facebook activity. When it finally applies a ranking logic to predict what images the user will want to see next, that analysis also includes data on the past behavior of the subject user. Instagram has machines doing this learning because humans cannot. In the case of more consequential analyses, the operations are likely to be equally or even more complex. This recalls our discussion of Facebook's prediction engine, FB Learner Flow, where the machines are fed tens of thousands of data points derived from behavioral surplus, diminishing the very notion of the right to contest automatic decision-making. If the algorithms are to be contestable in any meaningful way, it will require new countervailing authority and power, including machine resources and expertise to reach into the core disciplines of machine intelligence and construct new approaches that are available for inspection, debate, and combat. Indeed, one expert has already proposed the creation of a government agency, an FDA for algorithms, to oversee the development, distribution, sale, and use of complex algorithms, arguing that existing laws will prove no match for the difficult regulatory puzzles algorithms pose. Douay's experience is but one illustration of the self-sustaining nature of a pathological division of learning, and the insuperable burden placed on individuals moved to challenge its injustice. Douay is an activist, and his aim is not only to access data, but also to document the arduousness and even absurdity of the undertaking. Given these realities, he suggests that the data protection regulations are comparable to freedom of information laws. The procedures for requesting and receiving information under these laws are imperfect and onerous, typically undertaken by legal specialists, but nevertheless essential to democratic freedom. Although effective contest will require determined individuals, the individual alone cannot shoulder the burden of justice, any more than an individual worker in the first years of the 20th century could bear the burden of fighting for fair wages and working conditions. Those 20th century challenges required collective action, and so do our own. In her discussion of the life of the law, anthropologist Laura Nader reminds us that law projects possibilities of democratic empowerment, but that these are pulled forward into real life only when citizens actively contest injustice, using the law as a means to higher purpose. The life of the law is the plaintiff, Nader writes, a truth we saw brought to life in the action of the Spanish citizens who claimed the right to be forgotten. By contesting their injustices by means of law, plaintiffs and their lawyers can still decide the place of law in making history. These plaintiffs do not stand alone. They stand for citizens bonded together as the necessary means of confronting collective injustice. This brings us back to the GDPR and the question of its impact. The only possible answer is that everything will depend upon how European societies interpret the new regulatory regime in legislation and in the courts. It will not be the wording of the regulations, but rather the popular movements on the ground that shape these interpretations. A century ago, workers organized for collective action and ultimately tipped the scales of power. And today's users will have to mobilize in new ways that reflect our own unique 21st century conditions of existence. We need synthetic declarations that are institutionalized in new centers of democratic power, expertise, and contest that challenge today's asymmetries of knowledge and power. This quality of collective action will be required if we are finally to replace lawlessness with laws that assert the right to sanctuary and the right to the future tense as essential for effective human life. It is already possible to see a new awakening to empowering collective action, at least in the privacy domain. One example is None of Your Business, NOYB. A nonprofit organization led by privacy activist Max Schrems. After many years of legal contest, Schrems made history in 2015 when his challenge to Facebook's data collection and data retention practices, which he asserted were in violation of EU privacy law, led the Court of Justice of the European Union to invalidate the Safe Harbor Agreement that governed data transfers between the US and the EU. In 2018, Schrems launched NOYB as a vehicle for professional privacy enforcement. The idea is to push regulators to close the gap between written regulations and corporate privacy policies, leveraging the threat of significant fines to change a company's actual procedures. NOYB wants to become a stable European enforcement platform that unites groups of users and assists them through the litigation process while building coalitions and advancing targeted and strategic litigation to maximize the impact on the right to privacy. However this undertaking progresses, the key point for us is the way in which it points to a social void that must be filled with creative new forms of collective action, if the life of the law is to move against surveillance capitalism. Only time will tell if the GDPR will be a catalyst for a new phase of combat that wrangles and tames an illegitimate marketplace in behavioral futures, the data operations that feed it, and the instrumentarian society toward which they aim. In the absence of new synthetic declarations, we may be disappointed by the intransigence of the status quo. If the past is a prologue, then privacy, data protection, and antitrust laws will not be enough to interrupt surveillance capitalism. The reasons that we examined in answering the question, "How did they get away with it?" suggest that the immense and intricate structures of surveillance capitalism and its imperatives will require a more direct challenge. This is at least one conclusion from the past decade. Despite far more stringent privacy and data protection laws in the EU as compared to the US, as well as a forceful commitment to antitrust, Facebook and Google have continued to flourish in Europe. For example, between 2010 and 2017, the compounded annual growth rate for Facebook daily active users was 15% in Europe, compared to 9% in the US and Canada. During that period, the company's revenue grew by a compounded annual growth rate of 50% in both regions. Between 2009 and the first quarter of 2018, Google's share of the search market in Europe declined by about 2%, while increasing in the US by about 9%. Google's European market share remained high at 91.5% in 2018, compared to 88% in the US. In the case of its Android mobile phones, however, Google's market share increased by 69% in Europe, compared to 44% in the US. Google's Chrome browser increased its market share by 55% in Europe and 51% in the US. Those growth rates are not mere good fortune, as our list of how they got away with it suggests. In recognition of this fact, Europe's data protection supervisor Giovanni Buttarelli told the New York Times that the GDPR's impact will be determined by regulators who will be up against well-funded teams of lobbyists and lawyers. Indeed, corporate lawyers were already honing their strategies for the preservation of business as usual and setting the stage for the contests ahead. For example, a white paper published by one prominent international law firm rallies corporations to the barricades of data processing, arguing that the legal concept of legitimate interest offers a promising opportunity to bypass new regulatory obstacles. Legitimate interest may be the most accountable ground for processing in many contexts, as it requires an assessment and balancing of the risks and benefits of processing for organizations, individuals, and society. The legitimate interests of the controller or a third party may also include other rights and freedoms. The balancing test will sometimes also include freedom of expression, right to engage in economic activity, right to ensure protection of IP rights, etc. These rights must also be taken into account when balancing them against the individual's right to privacy. Surveillance capitalism's economic imperatives were already on the move in late April 2018, in anticipation of the GDPR taking effect that May. Earlier in April, Facebook's CEO had announced that the corporation would apply the GDPR in spirit across the globe. In practice, however, the company was making changes to ensure that the GDPR would not circumscribe the majority of its operations. Until then, 1.5 billion of its users, including those in Africa, Asia, Australia, and Latin America, were governed by terms of service issued by the company's international headquarters in Ireland, meaning that these terms fell under the EU framework. It was in late April that Facebook quietly issued new terms of service, placing those 1.5 billion users under U.S. privacy laws, and thus eliminating their ability to file claims in Irish courts. 3. Every unicorn has a hunter. What life is left to us if taming fails? Without protection from surveillance capitalism and its instrumentarian power, their behavioral aims and societal goals, we are trapped in a condition of no exit, where the only walls are made of glass. The natural human yearning for refuge must be extinguished and the ancient institution of sanctuary deleted. No exit is the necessary condition for Big Other to flourish, and its flourishing is the necessary condition for all that is meant to follow. The tides of behavioral surplus and their transformation into revenue, the certainty that we'll meet every market player with guaranteed outcomes, the bypass of trust in favor of the uncontract's radical indifference, the paradise of effortless connection that exploits the needs of harried second modernity individuals and transforms their lives into the means to others' ends, the plundering of the self, the extinction of autonomous moral judgment for the sake of frictionless control, the actuation and modification that quietly drains the will to will, the forfeit of your voice in the first person in favor of others' plans, the destruction of the social relations and politics of the old and slow and still unfulfilled ideas of self-determining citizens bound to the legitimate authority of democratic governance. Each of these exquisite unicorns has inspired the best that humanity has achieved, however imperfectly they have been fulfilled. But every unicorn has a hunter, and the ideals that have nurtured the liberal order are no exception. For the sake of this hunter, there can be no doors, no locks, no friction, no opposition between intimacy and distance, house and universe. There is no need for topoanalysis now, because all spaces have collapsed into the one space that is Big Other. Seek not the petal-soft, iridescent apex of the shell. There is no purpose to curling up in its dark spire. The shell is just another connected node, and your daydream is already finding an audience in the pulsating net of this clamorous glass life. In the absence of synthetic declarations that secure the road to a human future, the intolerability of glass life turns us toward a societal arms race of counter-declarations, in which we search for and embrace increasingly complex ways to hide in our own lives, seeking respite from lawless machines and their masters. We do this to satisfy our enduring need for sanctuary, and as an act of resistance with which to reject the instrumentarian disciplines of the hive, its extended chilling effects, and Big Other's relentless greed. In the context of government surveillance, the practices of hiding have been called privacy protests and are well known for drawing the suspicion of law enforcement agencies. Now, hiding is also invoked by Big Other and its market masters, whose reach is far and deep as they instill themselves in our walls, our bodies, and on our streets, claiming our faces, our feelings, and our fears of exclusion. I have suggested that too many of the best and brightest of a new generation devote their genius to the intensification of the clickstream. Equally more poignant is the way in which a new generation of activists, artists, and inventors feels itself called to create the art and science of hiding. The intolerable conditions of glass life compel these young artists to dedicate their genius to the prospects of human invisibility, even as their creations demand that we aggressively seek and find our bearings. Their provocations already take many forms: signal-blocking phone cases, false fingerprint prosthetics that prevent your fingertips from being used as a key to your life, LED privacy visors to impede facial recognition cameras, a quilted coat that blocks radio waves and tracking devices, a scent diffuser that releases a metallic fragrance when an unprotected website or network is detected on any of your devices, a serendipiter app to disrupt any surveillance that relies on subjects maintaining predictable routines, a clothing line called Glamouflage, featuring shirts covered with representations of celebrity faces to confuse facial recognition software, anti-neuroimaging surveillance headgear to obstruct digital invasion of brain waves, and an anti-surveillance coat that creates a shield to block invasive signals. Chicago artist Leo Salvaggio produces 3D printed resin prosthetic masks to confound facial recognition. He calls his effort an organized artistic intervention. Perhaps most poignant is the Backslash Toolkit, a series of functional devices designed for protests and riots of the future, including a smart bandana for embedding hidden images and public keys, independently networked wearable devices, personal black box devices to register abuse of law enforcement, and fast deployment routers for off-grid communication. Backslash was created as part of a master's thesis project at New York University, and it perfectly reflects the contest for the third modernity that this generation faces. The designer writes that, for young, digitally native protesters, connectivity is a basic human right. Yet, he laments, the future of technology in protests looks dark because of overwhelming surveillance. His toolkit is intended to create a space to explore and research the tense relationship between protests and technology, and a space to cultivate dialogue about freedom of expression, riots, and disruptive technology. In a related development, students at the University of Washington have developed a prototype for on-body transmissions with commodity devices. The idea here is that readily available devices can be used to transmit information to only wireless receivers that are in contact with the body, thus creating the basis for secure and private communications independent of normal Wi-Fi transmissions, which can be easily detected. Take a casual stroll through the shop at the New Museum for Contemporary Art in Manhattan, and you pass a display of its bestseller, tabletop mirrors whose reflecting surface is covered with the bright orange message, "Today's selfie is tomorrow's biometric profile." This Think Privacy selfie mirror is a project of the young Berlin-based artist Adam Harvey, whose work is aimed at the problem of surveillance and foiling the power of those who surveil. Harvey's art begins with reverse engineering computer vision algorithms in order to detect and exploit their vulnerabilities through camouflage and other forms of hiding. He is perhaps best known for his Stealthwear, a series of wearable fashion pieces intended to overwhelm, confuse, and evade drone surveillance and, more broadly, facial recognition software. Silver-plated fabrics reflect thermal radiation, enabling the wearer to avert overhead thermal surveillance. Harvey's fashions are inspired by traditional Islamic dress, which expresses the idea that garments can provide a separation between man and God. Now he redirects that meaning to create garments that separate human experience from the powers that surveil. Another Harvey project created an aesthetic of makeup and hairstyling. Blue feathers suspended from thick black bangs, dreadlocks that dangle below the nose, cheekbones covered in thick wedges of black and white paint, tresses that snake around the face and neck like octopus tentacles, all designed to thwart facial recognition software and other forms of computer vision. Harvey is one among a growing number of artists, often young artists, who direct their work to the themes of surveillance and resistance. Artist Benjamin Grosser's Facebook and Twitter demetricators are software interfaces that present each site's pages with their metrics deleted. The numbers of likes, friends, followers, retweets all disappear. How is an interface that foregrounds our friend count changing our conceptions of friendship, he asks. Remove the number and find out. Grosser's Go Rando project is a web browser extension that obfuscates your feelings on Facebook by randomly choosing an emoji each time you click like, thus undermining the corporation's surplus analyses as they compute personality and emotional profiles. Trevor Paglen's richly orchestrated performance art combines music, photography, satellite imagery, and artificial intelligence to reveal Big Other's omnipresent knowing and doing. It's trying to look inside the software that is running an AI, to look into the architectures of different computer vision systems and trying to learn what it is that they are seeing, Paglen says. Chinese artist Ai Weiwei's 2017 installation, Hansel and Gretel, created a powerful experience in which participants viscerally confront the surveillance implications of their own innocent picture-taking, Instagramming, tweeting, texting, tagging, and posting. Our artists, like our young people, are canaries in the coal mine. That the need to make ourselves invisible is the theme of a brilliant artistic vanguard is another kind of message in a bottle cast from the front lines of mourning and revulsion. Glass life is intolerable, But so is fitting our faces with masks and draping our bodies in digitally resistant fabrics to thwart the ubiquitous lawless machines. Like every counter-declaration, hiding risks becoming an adaptation when it should be a rallying point for outrage. These conditions are unacceptable. Tunnels under this wall are not enough. This wall must come down. The greatest danger is that we come to feel at home in glass life or in the prospect of hiding from it. Both alternatives rob us of the life-sustaining inwardness born in sanctuary that finally distinguishes us from the machines. This is the well from which we draw the capacities to promise and to love, without which both the private bonds of intimacy and the public bonds of society wither and die. If we do not alter this course now, we leave a monumental work for the generations that follow us. Industrial capitalism commandeered nature only to saddle the coming generations with the burden of a burning planet. Will we add to this burden with surveillance capitalism's invasion and conquest of human nature? Will we stand by as it subtly imposes the life of the hive while demanding the forfeit of sanctuary and the right to the future tense for the sake of its wealth and power? Paradiso calls it a revolution, and Pentland says it's the death of individuality. Nadella and Schmidt advocate the machine hive as our role model, with its coercive confluence and preemptive harmonies. Page and Zuckerberg understand the transformation of society as a means to their commercial ends. There are dissenters among us, to be sure, but the declaration of life without walls has thus far failed to trigger a mass withdrawal of agreement. This is in part the result of our dependency, and in part because we do not yet appreciate the breadth and depth of what the architects have in store, let alone the consequences that this revolution might entail. Our sensibilities grow numb to the monstrosity of Big Other as its features are developed, tested, elaborated, and normalized. We become deaf to the lullaby of walls. Hiding from the machines and their masters drifts from the obsessions of the vanguard to a normal theme of social discourse, and eventually our conversations around the dinner table. Each step down this path occurs as if in the fog of war. Scattered fragments and incidents that appear abruptly and often in obscurity. There is little room to perceive the pattern, let alone its origins and meaning. Nonetheless, each deletion of the possibility of sanctuary leaves a void that is seamlessly and soundlessly filled by the new conditions of instrumentarian power.